words, keep the discussion interesting. Is this a pointer?
And the yellow one, huh?
This one?
Oh, the yellow.
Turn it around.
Huh?
Yeah, I'll watch you go.
Yeah. I got it. Okay, so as the transparency shows, that's the title of my talk. I changed it a little bit just to bring it more in line with the other talks that have been given at this meeting over here. Somehow one had to compare quantum and classical mechanics. I will try to bring up certain aspects of quantum probability theory and classical probability theory, something that I have found very intriguing myself. So the aim of this talk is to pose a certain set of questions to which I don't have answers. And these came up in the last couple of years or so. I ran into a set of papers written by statisticians. Now, you know, statisticians, most statisticians we know, first of all, don't use group theory. Let's say, I'm not saying they don't know group theory. And secondly, they hardly ever talk about quantum mechanics. But there's been an interesting set of papers that I ran into some time ago, where some very fundamental quantum concepts are talked about, and in statistical terms, which I found extremely, it's amazing that this thing came up in a statistical context. So that's what I want to share with everyone over here. Mainly this, the mathematical objects that one is talking about, maybe the mathematical objects that one is talking about over here are coherent states, which seem to display certain both quantum and classical properties. Now, coherent states, as we know of them, I'm going to run through some of their well-known properties anyway for the benefit of people who might not be insiders to this game. You know, coherent states are something that you consider to be at the very heart of quantum mechanics and sort of the quantum classical interface, okay? And at the very heart of our understanding of quantum measurement theory, the process of quantum measurements, the transition to classical mechanics and all of that. But very surprisingly, there seem to be some very completely classical aspects to these things. And that's the intriguing part of it, which I wanted to bring up and talk about a little bit. So I'll start out by briefly running through some of the more well-known properties of coherent states, and then give a more general framework in which we understand coherent states these days, and then talk about a bit of how the statistical properties can be, one is trying to understand certain statistical properties in terms of coherent states. Okay, so the quintessential coherent states, which I call CCS, that means canonical coherent states. These are the old ones. They were discovered by Schrödinger, later on discussed by von Neumann, and then they came back into physical literature in the work of in quantum optics, and then basically flooded the physical literature. But the original coherent states were like this. I mean, you have a Hilbert space. Let's take that to be the simplest one, L2 of R. Okay? And we take this vector eta in the Hilbert space, which is basically the Gaussian ground state of the harmonic oscillator, this one. So we fix that vector. In the signal processing literature, this is called a mother wavelet, or it's called a mother Gavorov. Whatever. Anyway, so then to each point in R2, qp, I define a new vector, eta qp. They all have the same norm. And this vector is produced simply by translating and modulating, except for this space-time modulation. Okay, so that gives me a whole family of vectors in this Hilbert space. And then, as one knows, this family satisfies this resolution of the identity condition. This is exercise in first year of quantum mechanics. Okay, so those were the first set of coherent states that.
So,
original set of coherencies that appear in the literature, and people use them. Now, there's certain, again, rather well-known properties of these things, but let's go through some of them. First of all, if delta is any Borel set in R2, then corresponding to that delta, I can define a positive operator, A of delta, simply by integrating over that with respect to this measure. Okay? And now, if I let delta run through all Borel sets, this family of positive operators forms what I know a positive operator rather measure, which then allows one, in some interpretation of quantum mechanics, it allows for a joint measurement of position and momentum, okay, simultaneous measurement, of course, with inaccuracies, I mean, sort of complementary inaccuracies in position and momentum. And the probability measure, the probability measure that is then associated to it comes like this. You take a state vector phi in the Hilbert space, normalized to 1, of course, and then p phi of delta, the measure of that set delta, is just given by the scalar product, and this is the standard probability measure. Okay? And one can interpret this in terms of fuzzy measurements or joint measurements of position and momentum and all of that. This much of this is well known, it has been discussed or brought up several times in the course of the last few days. Okay. Also, these vectors have this minimal uncertainty property that if you calculate the standard deviation in position and in momentum, then the product of the standard deviations is, in fact, minimized, so it's exactly equal to half. Furthermore, there's a group theoretical interpretation of this, that you can just as well produce these coherent states, eta qp, simply by taking the first one, eta, with which we started, the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, and acting on it with those unitary operators. Now that unitary operator I've written down over here, c to the I qp, this is the momentum operator, that's the position operator, the standard position and momentum operators. And so that unitary operator acting on eta does produce this vector. On the other hand, these unitary operators also realize a multiplier representation of the Wien-Heisenberg group. So that's the group theoretical understanding of these coherent strings.
Correct?
Yes.
What's the meaning of multiplier?
Well, I mean, let me put it like this. The Wien-Heisenberg group is a three-parameter group. So there's the two parameters q, little p are there, and then there's one which is in the center, the phase. Okay, so I'm just eliminating the phase. So if you multiply two of these operators, uq, q1, q1, uq2, q2, you don't get uq1 plus.
It's a projective representation, put another way, right? Oh, same thing?
Yes.
No, but in fact, it's an ordinary representation.
It's an ordinary representation which has been, which out of which the phase has been modeled out. Okay?
No, but I think the correct statement would be it's a multiplied representation of R2 or R2n.
That's right. Yes. Thank you. It's a multiplied representation of R2, which is obtained by taking normal standard representation of the Wien-Heisenberg group and basically ignoring the phase. Yeah. Okay, so that's it. And then the next thing is these things, as Klaas just pointed out in his lecture a little while ago, I mean, you can just as well use these vectors to define a quantization of your classical observables. So if f, for example, is a function on phase space, now my phase space is just R2 in this case, okay? You take a function on phase space, and to it you associate this operator, this quantum operator, f hat, and you obtain this simply by integrating that function against this positive operator value measure that gives me an operator. And this in this particular context, it's not critical to see that this is a quantization. It maps multiplication by q into the position quantum position operator, multiplication by p into the quantum momentum operator, and so on, all these things. And it also has the proper asymptotic limit made famous by Cassel's last talk. So that's a perfect example of a population of a classical system. So all of these properties are in some very delicate way woven into the fabric of these coherent strings. Okay, one last property that I want to bring out. I mean, one can discuss all kinds of properties of coherent strings and all that, and there's an enormous literature on this thing. One last way of rephrasing these vectors, it's like this. Let's introduce this complex number z, which is q minus ip over the square root of 2. And then I just relabel eta qp by z. So these two things are the same thing. It's just labeled differently. And it's not hard to see that this vector can then be written out as its infinite expansion in powers of z. Then this normalization constant, which is basically e to the mod z squared, z to the power n divided by n factorial, and these vectors, the n kets, and those are the normalized eigenvectors of the harmonic oscillator. Okay, as soon as you do that, you realize that if you take any vector in the Hilbert space, phi, and take its scalar product with z, that vector, what you get is this thing, e to the minus mod z squared times a function f of z, which is entire analytic. So it belongs to this Hilbert space, h, the L2 of the holomorphic part of this thing. And this is typical of coherent states which have infinite expansions like this. Okay? And we'll look at generalizations of this kind of coherent states in a little while. Okay, so far everything is quantum mechanical. Let's look at certain naturally associated probability distributions to this particular family. So first of all, this one, phi z, which I wrote down earlier, this is just the density associated to the POV measure in the state phi, and it's just defined like that, okay? So that's a probability measure, probability in QP on R2. It integrates out to 1 and all that. So this is a quantum probability density for localization in phase space. Okay, now let's do something slightly different. I introduce this parameter lambda, write z in complex terms, the square root of lambda times e to the I theta, lambda is positive and theta goes from 0 to 2 pi. And then if I calculate the expectation value of this square and state in z square against this object, what is that? That's exactly the, if you let n run through 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, that's exactly the Poisson distribution. And where did the Poisson distribution come from? That's not even quantum. In fact, I don't know, I mean, one of the apocryphal stories about the origin of the Poisson distribution was that this was discovered by Poisson when he was trying to study the number of deaths in the Austrian army due to horse kicks. So the probability of an Austrian soldier dying due to horse kick is rather small, and the distribution of that is given by this. Now, you realize that that's not a very complimentary thing to do, to say about soldiers in a certain army, but this was the French versus the Austrians anyway. Okay, so, all right, so there's a Poisson distribution that comes out over here, which is perfectly classical. Okay, now there's some more distributions that come up. Oh, by the way, that parameter lambda that appears over there is it's the average number of successes. Now, in this case, a success means a death due to horse kick. And you can imagine, a French mathematician would consider an Austrian soldier dying to be a success. So, and of course, if you sum over all n's, you get 1, so it's a probability distribution, okay? But on the other hand, it's also the quantum probability for finding n excitons in that state, all right? And this is naturally associated to this family of coherent states. Now, secondly, this parameter lambda, which enters into the Poisson distribution, that's the average number of deaths, okay? And this itself could be thought of as a random variable. I mean, you know, if instead of looking at the Austrian army, you looked at the Indian army or something like that, the average number of deaths would probably be different. So this is presumably a random variable which has some kind of a distribution of its own. Now the question is, how do we find that distribution? Or is there something within the structure of coherent states which gives us such a distribution? And indeed, this is the case, because look, if you think of lambda as a random variable, and you just integrate this, Pn lambda with respect to lambda, you do get 1. So you can think of Pn lambda as a distribution for fixed n. You can think of this as a distribution in lambda, and then this distribution it's just uniformly distributed over 0 infinity. And this uniform distribution is being given by the coherent states. So in a sense, this parameter, the statistical parameter which appears over here, is in some sense being, the distribution of this parameter is in some sense being governed by this coherent states. Okay, there's something to think about over here. It's a completely, in statistics, I mean, there's no quantum mechanics over there. Nevertheless, you can build these coherent states starting from the Pn lambda, which we'll do in a minute, and then you seem to have this distribution. So what does this all mean? Okay, finally, there's one other measure that is naturally associated, because I mean, it comes from there, which is put on the phase space by these coherent states, and that measure is e to the minus lambda b lambda b theta. It comes in naturally in all of this, and that again is a probability measure. So these coherent states are putting a probability measure on phase space itself, on the parameter space itself. So there's this whole plethora of probability measures of different types coming up over here. And as I will try to show, or as people have tried to show, is that this is not incidental. I mean, you can take practically any discrete statistical distribution and get a family of coherent states and get all these different kinds of probability distributions associated with that. So there's something that you don't understand here and something that needs further study. Okay, so before I leave this subject of this thing about even before that, let me just point out a certain duality that exists between the lambda and the n. You know, Pn of lambda can be thought of as the probability distribution for the continuous parameter lambda or for the discrete parameter n. And if you take the average of lambda over this distribution, you get n plus 1. On the other hand, if you take the average of n, the discrete distribution, with respect to this distribution, you get lambda. So there's a certain kind of duality which recurs again and again in all other situations that I'm aware of. Okay, so let's just reverse the process for a minute, okay? Now suppose I say I was a statistician who knew no quantum mechanics, nothing. All I know is the Poisson distribution. Okay, and what I'm trying to understand is if I allow this lambda to be random variable itself, is there some way by which I could arrive at a distribution for lambda? Okay. All right. So let's do the following. This is completely classical. I have a Poisson distribution. I just introduce this complex variable over here. Okay, and take an abstract Hilbert space, infinite dimensional abstract Hilbert space over the complexes, assume it to be separable, and I take an orthonormal basis in that Hilbert space, okay? And in this Hilbert space, I define a set of vectors, Z, for each complex number Z, I define a set of vectors by this prescription, okay? It's Pn, and these are just the coefficients of that Pn. Okay, but that precisely gives me my coherent states, okay? They have norm 1. If I write it out completely, they look like that. And I have my resolution of the identity, everything. More or less, this family of coherent states that immediately puts a distribution on the lambda, which is the uniform distribution on 0, 9. So I didn't have to know any quantum mechanics. I could just say, look, I have this family of distribution functions, E and lambda, and I'm going to say, you know, is there a clever way to find a square root of this distribution function? The coherent states, in fact, give me a kind of a square root of that, because when you square this, you do get. Yes?
You say a couple times that this is uniform, the lambda, I don't see that. I mean, you think uniform, you think of it as being constant on intervals.
Yeah, it is.
Uniform.
It's just the lambda.
It's just the lambda.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
It's same level.
The lambda is really not uniform, I guess. It's not constant, but it's not constant. It's distributed.
Well,
intervals.
No, I mean, it's not uniform in the sense that fluctuation invariant and all that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the measure of each interval is just the length of that interval.
Length.
In that sense, yes. Yeah.
So I'm trying to follow up. I'm a little concerned by the square root of a distribution.
I put it under quotes.
Yes, yes. But I'm trying to probe a little bit in it and understand what this means rigorously. Because of course, a distribution is not a function. It's something that doesn't have values. It has intervals, right? And so taking a square, I know what it means to take a square root of a function, but a distribution always has a measure attached to it. It's, you know, P of lambda, D lambda. And I can't take the square root of D lambda.
Well, you can think of it like this. Each Pn lambda is some sort of it's a function, okay? It's a function. Think of it as a vector in some space, right? And I'm sort of trying to find the square root of this vector. And you do this, such things all the time in physics. I mean, you get relativistic quantum mechanics essentially by taking the square root of a certain Hamiltonian.
So I guess
so. It's in that sense. I mean, it's not like what I'm saying is that it's in precisely this sense that if you take this vector, it compute its norm. That's the square of that vector essentially.
Right.
Okay, it gives me back the distribution.
Would you accept the resolution that you're assuming the Lebesgue measure on lambda? There's a preferred d lambda here.
No, here it's not with respect to lambda, really, it's more with respect to n.
Yes, but you also have a continuous distribution over lambda, right?
Yes, I do, yeah.
And so when you do that, I think you have to assume a preferred measure in order to, because if you take the measure p of lambda d lambda, right, and you want to square root that, and it seems that you have to divide out the
No, I don't think that's what I mean over here. What I mean over here is, this thing, it's a square root, you see, for any z, in other words, for any lambda, okay, that vector gives, in some sense, a square root of these distribution functions.
Isn't it rather like going from probabilities to amplitudes?
Yes. That is right. So, no, I mean, I'm not going to make a big issue of this thing. It's kind of tantalizing to think of this in terms of a square root like that. Okay? Okay. Good. So, all right. So, all of that works out. Not only that, then I could make quantum mechanics out of this also. I can just get my position and momentum observables simply by, you know, I can define shift operators very easily. I can define shift operators on these vectors, and that way get my position and momentum operators and recover from this. I mean, do the commutation equations and all that. I don't want to go into that, but that's a fairly trivial exercise. Okay, so all of these things come out of the canonical coherent states, okay? So the question is, I mean, this is just one example. What more can we say? Well, before we say something more about these things, we have to generalize this framework of coherent states. So let me very quickly do this. Talk about generalized coherent states, and I do it, you know, there are many different ways of talking about generalizations of coherent states, and there are any number of books in the literature that do it in different ways, but I will do it in the way that's most convenient for the discussion over here. It's like this. I want to generalize that concept of canonical coherent states. So, what you do is we take an abstract Hilbert space, and its dimension could be finite or infinite. It's taken to be separable over the complexes, and so on. This is a measure space, x d nu. X is a measure space, d nu is the measure, probability measure associated to it. And let's say to each point in x, I associate a family of n vectors, capital N, this is finite n, okay, and I write them like this, theta I x. This x is a continuous index coming from x, and I is a discrete index going from 1 to up to n, okay? So I pick a set of vectors in this Hilbert space labeled by those two parameters. And I assume the following properties on that set of vectors. That if I fix x and let I run, I get a linearly independent set. So for each x, this set of vectors is linearly independent. And secondly, this function for fixed I, theta x, if I take any vector in the Hilbert space, calculate the scalar product, then for fixed I, this function, x to theta I xp, this is measurable. And the third crucial property is that this operator integral weakly converges to the identity on the Hilbert space, H. Okay? That's it. So, a family of vectors in the Hilbert space which satisfies those properties, I call them generalized coherent states, or just coherent states, okay? This time it's got nothing to do with optical coherence, it's got nothing to do with minimal uncertainty, it's just a mathematical object. Now generally, if this n is 1, they're called coherent states, and if this n is bigger than 1, they're called vector coherent states, but that's a nuance. Now there are some immediate properties of these vectors that one can immediately check. First of all, there's an isometry between that Hilbert space in which I chose those vectors and Cn cross L2 of x d mu. You realize the x d mu was my measure space, so L2 of that, Cn cross that. And so here's the isometry. I denote it by W, it's a linear isometry, W acting on phi at the point of the component I at the point x is just given by this. Now this mapping is a linear isometry, and that isometry arises from this fact, the resolution of the identity. It's easy to check. Good. Now, the range of that isometry, H gets embedded inside this. It's not the whole Hilbert space, but it gets embedded inside this. And that range I denote by HK. This is the image of H under W. Okay, and that's a reproducing kernel in Hilbert space, which means that it's got an operator kernel with certain properties and all that. Okay, so here's the operator kernel associated with it, and I don't really want to spend much time on that. That happens, and this positive operator valued measure that's naturally associated to it. I mean, this is the positive operator Bell-Ripp measure, which we had for the economical coherent states, but now in this more general context. Okay? It's a normalized Q. We always get that. Okay. So, some examples. Now, very quickly, let me run through a few examples. The first one we already discussed, so I don't want to talk about that anymore. It has got all these analytic properties, which you also discussed. But those are not the only ones. Here are some more. Let's look at him, this one. There's a family of coherent states which we will generically call nonlinear coherent states. I mean, this term nonlinear comes from quantum optics. In quantum optics, this kind of coherent states are called nonlinear because they relate to nonlinear phenomena in the optical field. Okay, they're a bit like this. I again take an orthonormal basis in my Hilbert space, and suppose I have a sequence of numbers, positive numbers, x0 is 0, and then x1, x2, xn, so on, okay? And I introduce this notation that x0 factorial by definition is 1, xn factorial is just x1, x2, x3, xn, etc. And now I assume that this sequence, xn factorial, is a moment sequence, which means the following. I assume that there exists a measure d lambda on 0 L half. L is the radius of convergence of this sequence. Okay, it's the limit of this sequence. So I assume that there exists a lambda, a measure lambda, such that R2m d lambda gives me exactly that. Now, you see, in the case of the standard coherent states, that would just be d lambda would simply be e to the minus lambda d lambda. Okay, that would give me the gamma function, which would be n factorial, and this 2 pi is just a constant put into it. Okay? Now, just given that data, just given a sequence, there's no guarantee that I have a measure associated with this thing. Okay? I mean, it may or may not happen. The measure might not exist. The measure might be unique. The measure might, you know, like the solution might be, you may have an infinite number of solutions. So all these things can happen. But let's assume we do have such a measure. Okay? And then with that, I define this one here, which is the sum of this series. And I define my coherent states, these nonlinear coherent states now, just like this. For each z, now, each complex number inside this domain D, which is defined by mod z being less than L, which is the radius of convergence of that sequence. It should be mod z squared less than L, or I should put a half on that L. So I define my coherent states like this, exactly as the canonical coherent states were defined. Okay? Now, they again have nice analytic properties and all that. And it will turn out that it's this family of coherent states, this generalized family of coherent states, which will be associated to other statistical distributions. Okay? Not necessarily you can have a generalized Poisson distribution, you can have this Loch-Rober distribution, all kinds of other distributions. Okay, so they can be all captured by means of this type of coherent states. Okay. For people who like this kind of thing, this is totally unrelated, but associated to each family of such nonlinear coherent states, there's a beautiful family of orthogonal polynomials because you can generate recursion relations for three-term recursion relations for orthogonal polynomials by this means. And then what happens is that with a naturally associated orthogonal or set of orthogonal polynomials to any such family of coherent states. Okay, but that's something unrelated in this context. Okay, now just to give some examples of nonlinear coherent states. See, these ones are very well known. This one, okay, And that Z runs over the unit disk over there. I have to define it a little bit. This is the Fock Hammer symbol, 2KM. Like that. KM is gamma A plus N divided by N factorial. And then one can check that this family of coherent states satisfies a resolution of the identity of this type. So these are also known as the SU11 coherent states. And if you're doing statistics, if you start out with a negative binomial distribution, go through the same process as I did for the Poisson distribution, you arrive at these coherent states, the SU11 coherent states. And that's kind of amazing because, somehow this symmetry somehow doesn't seem to be built into these statistical distributions, but nevertheless, they are there. Now, for the SU11 group, there's another family of coherent states that one can write down, and these are defined on the whole complex plane. These are the Barum-Girardello types, and, good. Another intriguing family of coherent states that I want to discuss now, and these are more recently sort of discovered, or whatever you want to call it. This is some joint work with Miriam English in Prague and Rabia Gazot in Paris. And the idea is the following. You see, the nonlinear coherent states that I wrote down earlier, the Z that appeared over there was a single complex number, or it was a complex variable. Now we ask ourselves the question, this is just for the fun of it. Can I replace that complex variable over there by some matrix variable, take it from some domain, and then try to get coherent states that way? Okay? So what do I have to do? I have to choose these numbers over here appropriately. I have to choose a measure over this, whatever my domain is. And of course, I have to choose my domain also appropriately so that everything works out. Okay, so that I can have a resolution of the identity like this, all right? And surprisingly, there are lots of matrix domains over which this can be done. In particular, we could take the set of all n by n complex numbers and find coherent states. You see, computing these quantities becomes difficult over there, but fortunately, there's this vast literature on matrix models that we can accrue to, and many of these matrices or matrix integrals have been worked out there, which can be used. So what I'm saying is that there are a large number of matrix domains that we know over which we can build coherent states like that. And in particular, for example, the domain of all n by n complex matrices, or n by n normal matrices, n by n normal matrices with certain restrictions and things like that. Okay. So, here, I've just written down some of those things. If my domain is a set of all n by n normal matrices, the xn factorials, the measure that over which I want to integrate is like that. And anyway, so I mean, we have computed all of those things. Now, interestingly enough, if we look at the set of all normal matrices, in other words, my domain is now all matrices such that Z in Cn cross Cn such that Zz star equals Z star Z. Okay, these are normal matrices, which means that any Z can be written as U star du, where U is a diagonal matrix with complex entries in the on the diagonal, and U is a UN matrix, orthogonal matrix, okay? If we take that set of matrices, then with respect to this measure, e to the minus trace Z star Z, du is the invariant measure on un, and dz1, that's just a vague measure over there, then this family of vectors defines for me a beautiful set of vector coherent states. You see, the xi's key i's are an orthonormal basis in Cn. So for each I, I have, for instance, each I and ez, each z, and they satisfy the resolution of the identity and all that. And they also look very much like the standard coherent states in the sense that there's an operator which acting on a basis state gives me all these coherent states. So that's very nice. Okay. So let's come back. Let's come back to statistics again. Okay. And let's try to do the following. Now that we have at our disposal whole families of coherent states to work at, let's try to analyze a couple other statistical distributions and how and see how they fit into this framework. Okay, so what's your favorite distribution? Toss a coin. The binomial distribution. What do you expect those coherent states to be? Any physics student should be immediately able to make a clever guess. What? Where should those coherent states come from? What? Rotation group, right? And it does. Okay, so let's do it. It's a cute little exercise to work out. Okay, so I'm flipping a coin, okay? N is the number of trials. Q is the probability of success that, in other words, the probability that a head will come up in any given trial. And P is 1 minus Q, the probability of failure. Then we all know that, you know, the probability distribution goes like this. The probability of N successes in capital N trials is given by this. NCN, that's the combinatorial factor, Q to the power N, P to the power N minus N, and that's this. Okay? Of course, they all add up to 1, their probability. All right, fine. So now, let's play the same game. I just changed the variable. So I introduced this new variable lambda, q over p, and now you see lambda goes from 0 to infinity. Q goes from 0 to 1, of course. Lambda goes from 0 to infinity. And so I rewrite my probabilities, p and q, in terms of lambdas. And in terms of lambda, that object just looks like that. Okay? So now let me introduce a complex variable, as before, z at the square root of lambda e to the I of theta in C. And let me take this time a finite dimensional Hilbert space, n plus 1. N, capital N, is the number of trials, n plus 1 dimensional Hilbert space. And in that, I take an orthonormal basis, Pn. Okay? And I define my coherent states like this. Is the square root of n lambda, exactly as I did it in the case of the Poisson distribution. Okay, the same prescription. And in terms of z, that now looks like this. Okay? All right. But those are precisely the coherent states that appear out of the rotation group. So let's look at that. The nz, that normalization factor that I introduced, was this. And then these states are now normalized to 1 because it's the sum of probabilities. They satisfy a resolution of the identity. This one can check. Okay? And let us now introduce these complex functions in z bar rather than in z. I take those factors, okay, those factors, and take the square root of that and multiply that by z bar to the power n. This is a complex function in z bar. And these are orthonormal with respect to this measure that I have written down over here. Okay? So that's an orthonormal family of vectors, and then they span a Hilbert space, n plus one dimensional Hilbert space, and so I can just take these vectors and replace in my original definition of my coherent space, I can replace the pn's, which was some, these pn's that I had in the original definition of my coherent space, which came from an abstract Hilbert space. It can be any abstract Hilbert space or any Hilbert space. I replace those Tn's by these psi n's. Okay? And now I rewrite my coherent states. Sorry, this should be a Z bar over there.
That's a Z bar, yeah.
Okay, and now just do a relabeling of it. So that capital N, this is the number of trials, I write that as 2 times J. So J becomes either an integer or a half integer. And that K, that variable K, I introduce that variable as N minus J. And then this sum just goes from K going from minus J to plus J. Okay? And if you look at the literature on coherent states, those are precisely the coherent states associated to the rotation group, to the 2k plus 1 irreducible representation of the rotation group. And in fact, you can do something, you can show the following, in fact, which is that those coherent states can be written like this. Z as e to the z j plus, this is the standard raising operator, this is the lowering operator, and that's j3. Eta is this number over here. That z is precisely this operator acting on the lowest vector. Okay? So you take the representation of the rotation group and you generate these. Well, that's amazing. That, you know, you stand out for something, you're flipping coins on this. Where does the rotational symmetry come from? But nevertheless, this thing is coming. Okay, and finally,
so where does this come from?
I don't know. This is the question. I started out by saying that I'm going to ask a number of questions to which I don't know the answers.
But which G is actually set to the movie rotation group? Because I don't. I think this guy can make help. Because according to flipping, there's two variables. There's vertical motion and one-dimensional rotation. So you would expect R at times as O2.
That's not really happening. So I said I was intrigued by this, and I didn't understand it. So I wanted to put it before the jury of public opinion and see what people have to say. Okay, now, the thing is, the coherent states again gives me the resolution of the identity, again delivers distribution, okay, on the parameter space, namely Q, or lambda in this case. And once again, you can see that on Q, it's a uniform distribution. In other words, it's just dQ on that parameter space. Okay, so, it's kind of... Alright, so we can continue playing this game. Just to give you an example, suppose I have a multiple Poisson process. In other words, I have capital N Poisson processes, okay? And I'm with parameters lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda n, okay? We're counting the number of deaths happening in the French army, in the German army, in the Swiss army, in whatever, okay? All these things. And they obviously, I mean, presumably, they have different parameters, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda n. And all I'm interested in is finding the probability of n successes, okay? N dead Frenchmen, n dead Germans, n dead whatever. That's all I'm interested in, okay? So what is the probability in that case? You see, for each one of these distributions looks like this, Pn lambda j, okay, it's like that, it's a Poisson distributed. And we are looking for n successes coming from any one of these n processes. So that I denote by Pn lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda n, and it's clearly just 1 over n, sum over those probabilities. What's the corresponding coherent state that we can associate with this? Yes. Yeah. Before I put the next answer, you know, it was not for nothing that I introduced those matrix coherent states. Okay, so this time this matrix done with Gordon strings, I mean, they're beautiful. You see? Of course, you know, this thing is true that if I sum over all these probabilities, I get one. And so the same question, can we build coherent states for this system? Well, let's introduce these complex numbers again, as before. Okay, Zj, now I have n of these complex numbers, square root of lambda j to the I theta j in this. And I define this matrix, capital Z, or this gothic Z, it's B times the diagonal matrix. This is the diagonal matrix with Z1, Z2, Zn along the diagonals. And I multiply by a B here and a B star. This B is a UN unitary matrix. So that gives me, this whole thing is a normal matrix. Zz star equals Z star Z. Okay? And I define this diagonal matrix, this kind of an N. Okay? You know, in tech, it's math BD or BDD. So what's the... or math. But I don't know what the real name of this thing is. What is it called? What kind of a... It's not script, and it's not a
Gothic.
Blackboard? It's a blackboard font.
Yeah, it's a blackboard font, I know. So it should be called a blackboard and... Okay.
Blackboard?
Blackboard or anything.
Black, there it goes.
Okay. Not very convincing.
I was careful, but I can just...
Okay. Okay, so it's this blackboard N is this diagonal matrix, e to the minus lambda 1, e to the minus. Okay? Those lambdas are the parameters of the distribution. Okay, so now again I take an abstract Hilbert space and an orthonormal basis in that Hilbert space. And I'm going to construct vectors which now lie in this tensor product. See, in other words, this matrix space with a trace norm. Okay, this is the space of n by n matrices with a trace norm and H. Okay, that tensor product. So I'm going to build vectors in that tensor product, and I do it like this: 1 over n, and then I think the B star should be here. That should be a V, but it doesn't matter. So B star, then this diagonal matrix, okay, like that, which can then be written very neatly like this. These are like an n-dimensional version now of my the particle coherent states. And this is coming from n Poisson processes, whereas in the first case they came from a single Poisson. And then, of course, you know, Zz, this norm is 1, and all that, everything works out. The resolution of the identity is exactly what you would guess. You get all of that. But that now models this process. I mean, I have n Poisson processes going on, and these are the coherent states appropriate for that process. Okay. You have this probability interpretation. So all the probabilities that I had for the canonical coherent state situation, I again have over here. Okay, so of course I can continue this analysis for any number of other situations. As many as I have worked out, it always works. So for the I did it for the binomial distribution and for the Poisson distribution. If you take the geometric distribution, of course it works. That's the bottom representation of the discrete series of SU11 corresponding to half, j equals to a half. All the other distributions that statisticians use, for all of them, we can construct coherent states. Now, what is more interesting is that we can take these other families of coherent states and construct statistical distributions corresponding to that. So it's a two-way kind of game. Okay, so that was basically what I wanted to say scientifically, but then a couple of days ago, Paul Bush told me that I had to have the last word. And so what can I say? You see, quantum mechanics, because perhaps it is so counterintuitive, never ceases to throw up interesting, amazingly further counterintuitive problems, questions, and all of that. We always tend to learn, no matter how much we learn about it, there are always things that seem to come up that we don't know about. So perhaps it's a good point to end with a rubaiyat from Umar Khayyam. Myself, when young, did eagerly frequent doctor and saint, and heard great argument about it and about, but each time came out by the same door as in I went. Thank you.
I'll try and attempt it, expecting more. SC2 arises from the binomial, it's just an idea. I mean, one way of constructing a spin J representation of SC2 is to take two J spin half particles and just make them point in the same direction. These will give you the SC2 coherent state, right? And if you write that, if you express these states in a basis that just counts how many are pointing up and how many are pointing down, these, the coefficient will be binomial coefficient, right? Just given by the
you symmetrize that tensor. In other words, you just symmetrize that tensor so you get that. Yeah.
So that's a very natural way of arriving at it.
Yeah, but sure, I mean, this is the mechanical way of arriving at these things. But is there something deeper why this particular distribution shows up in the binomial case? I mean, work backwards. I mean, I can understand why SE2 representations, I mean, we all work with Young tableaus and things like that. We know why these combinatorial factors should appear, okay? But now flipping a coin and getting combinatorial factors over there, yeah, I mean, it's a certain stretch of the imagination to go from there to the other one. So I'm not saying, I don't know if there's something really deep in it or if this is something coincidental, but it's definitely intriguing. Yes.
I may be saying effectively the same thing, but trying to compress it a little bit. Would it be trivial to say that, look, you're flipping a coin many times? A coin is a bit. When you quantize a bit, you get a qubit, whose symmetry group is SU2 in the block sphere. So you have many coins, right? So coin, therefore, SU2.
Coin.
Yeah.
Coin is equivalent to bits, therefore SU2, yeah?
Or SU1.
Yeah. No, that was going to be my answer. You see, I mean, if you take the negative binomial distribution, for which you won't have this kind of, okay, you get SU11 representations. Or if you take, also, if you take the geometric distribution, okay, you know, that you stop when you get the first success. And if you take the geometric distribution, you again get an SE11, coherent states coming from an SE11 representation, but not from the discrete series, but at the bottom of the discrete series. And so, not only that, I mean, you can take all of these coherent states that come from semi-simple V-groups, you know, discrete series representations of semi-simple V groups. You have families of coherent states. Oh, another thing that I didn't mention, I mean, once you go to higher domains, let's say of semi-simple V groups, and you have these higher domains where you're working with several complex variables. Okay, you get coherent states involving not a single complex variable, but, you know, Z1 times Z2, Z1 to the power N1, Z2 to the power N2, and things like that, that kind of thing. Then, again, I think there's a very neat explanation of that in terms of, you see, now you're trying to look, you have a number of processes going on, and you're counting the probabilities of getting N1 successes from this one and N2 from that one, so you have compound probabilities. So all these things come in, and it's rather amazing that this is happening.
Is it possible that this doesn't have anything to do with groups? In other words, you could take any old discrete probability distribution and then cook up general Weiss coherent states to capture any distribution.
No.
Is that possible, do you think?
Yes, indeed. No, I didn't mention that. You see, for example, these what we call the, those non-linear coherent states, where you have something like this, z n to the minus half, and then some n going from 0 to infinity, z to the power n divided by xn factorial. Now, these xn factorials could be very wide sequences, okay? Phi n. So you have coherent states. I mean, if this is a Wolgen sequence, you can get a resolution of the identity and all of that. Mm-hmm. So you do have coherent states over here. Then you can just turn it around and say, well, then I do have a probability distribution which will be like this. Pn lambda is this. It's lambda to the power n, and this factor, n lambda, and then xn factorial. This is some kind of a generalized Poisson distribution, if you wish. So, yeah, indeed.
And then there
doesn't have to be a proven problem. Uh-huh. Although what is even more interesting is that you can associate quantum groups to that also, because if you choose these things appropriately, you can get into quantum groups also.
So this means that every time you're a group, because you have a tensor representation such that some irreducible space correspond.
You see, it's
the same argument you accept.
And you need a little more than that. You need first of all a group which admits what one calls square integrable representations. Okay, and so in other words, that resolution of the identity, that's a very strict constraint on the thing, and not all groups have representations which admit a resolution of the identity. So, for such groups, yes, one should be able to correspond in statistical probability distribution. And this is funny, because you see, these were found by some statisticians who read in those things. What we succeeded in doing is to sort of include compound processes, multiple processes, and all that by the use of vector coherent states over matrix elements. Yeah, sorry.
So you're saying that you take your favorite classical distribution and you can generate these generalized coherent states in this way, but will all these coherent states be physically relevant? And then does that change the question?
No, whether
it's just a matter of curiosity.
It's more like a curiosity. You see, first of all, you see the original coherent states have some very physical properties. Namely, the optical beam in those states were coherent, and they had this minimal uncertainty property and all these other physical properties. But when one did the generalization was purely mathematical, okay? I mean, it was by group theoretic or holomorphic analogy kind of to go into development. So they don't necessarily have to have any quote-unquote physical interest, but a lot of stuff that we read in the physical literature, which gets published in the physical review, does that really happen in physical development?
Just a very brief note on that. One of the other nice properties of coherent states for in phase space or optical phase space is that under a lot of a broad range of conditions, they appear as the minor states, the states that are robust to decoherence. Yeah. And there's been some work recently showing that this generalizes to other manifolds, that, again, under fairly broad ranges of conditions, the coherent states will show up as being the, according to decoherence, quote, classical manifold states. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's a physical application of these things.
Yeah, but there also, you see, one big question is what has to be a little careful, because in the literature, see, the starting point is the canonical coherent states, and then one tries to generalize. And there are different ways of generalizing, on which mathematical aspect do you keep, and which ones are you willing to sacrifice for this generalization. So you can do a generalization in the direction of what they call intelligent states, and which have some kind of a minimal uncertainty property, but not necessarily a resolution of the identity. or you can go in the direction of a resolution of the identity and then give up minimal uncertainty condition, or you can do a strictly holomorphic thing, like you preserve the holomorphic properties but nothing else. So there are all these possibilities. When you go to generalization, you can do so many different things.
Well, I have a question, if I'm allowed to ask one. No one else, please. It's on a similar note. The point is coherent states come in two guises, as far as I understand. Let's take what is the role of quantization theory, which you mentioned. So from a coherent state, you get a POVM. From the POVM, you get a Bayesian type of quantization map. On the other hand, the operational quantum physicists say that you have to describe experiments in terms of POVM. So what's the relationship between the coherent state built POVMs and the POVMs in measurement theory? Because these are usually dictated, your type, symmetry arguments, yeah, it's basically group theory or statistics. What's the relationship between such coherent states and their POVMs and the POVMs as in your books? Is that never understood?
Those are a subset.
But when would you see it in an operational?
This corresponds, for example, to the measurement of the direction on the angular momentum in which you are forcing a continuous probability space on a finite dimensional Hilbert space. Uh-huh. You say, I want to measure the direction, and this would be described by the POVM of the SU2 coherent states if you are in dimension.
Uh-huh. And the Heisenberg coherent states, or the Schrodinger ones, actually?
No, I think these would be more the ones that you're talking about. If you're talking about functional measurements, these would more be like the ones coming from SU2, right?
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. But the Heisenberg ones, you people used it in a different context, no?
Huh. Well, I thought you mentioned that already, to joint measurements.
No, but not so much in the context of measurement, but more in the context of measuring. Because what he's saying is more in the context of measuring.
But this is a class question, right?
Yeah, I thought that was the
measure
meaning.
Yeah.
With
joint
P and Q, you get
precisely
these P and Q.
Right. Mm. When you measure jointly all components.
But even for that joint measurement thing, it's not necessary to have these canonical coherent states. The canonical coherent states are a bit like this. You take that ground state, which would be Gaussian, okay, and then you acted on it with UQP. Now, in principle, you can take any vector of norm 1, not necessarily the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, and then build UQP, which would also have a resolution of the identity, and it would also have give rise to joint measurements, just that your uncertainty in position and momentum, it will not be...
This is just the covariance. If you measure the angular momentum, if you rotate the system, then the result is rotated. Mm-hmm. And then you can change the quality of your QPF by changing
this. Here, the thing is, the uncertainty that you obtain in position and in momentum, you have this minimal uncertainty. Mm-hmm. So the product is... But if you take some other vector, that product will be bigger than half.
Not if it's a pure one, I don't think so.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yes. Ah, yes, for P and Q, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, but you can also squeeze.
Yeah, you can squeeze. But squeezing just means instead of taking the bottom of the Gaussian, you're just taking a squeezed Gaussian.
But the only common feature is the covariance.
No more questions?
Well, I could offer a non-scientific comment.
Okay.
Tarek, you raised this blackboard bold question. Yeah. I have a possible explanation for the invention of that name. I can remember times where blackboards were much harder than today, and pieces of chalk were much drier. So when you wrote, they broke, and when you continued to write, you notice that the breaking surface was convex and you started writing double lines.
So that's why they're called blackboard forward.
It's a possibility.
Okay. Good. Well, all this now, let's think. Paul is the organizer and after the target and all the speakers and the audience.